Welcome, everybody, to Jawanza for Life. My name is Jawanza. The show is also known as Health, Wealth, and Divine. It is a beautiful day. I'm so very, very excited this morning. I have an opportunity to share with you some information, a very, very powerful brother that you are going to really, really enjoy this show. I guarantee it. And I just want to let you know from the outset that if you decide you want to join in the conversation, don't be shy. If you're listening by phone, all you have to do is press 1, and that will let me know that you want to jump in discussion, and I can bring you on. If you're listening online, the call-in number is 347-324-5727. That's 347-324-5727. Well, everybody, you know why you're here. You've seen the title of the show, Farmer to Farmer, Liberia at the Crossroads. Liberia is at the crossroads. You know, everybody, we do shows on health, wealth, and divine. We talk about spirituality. We talk about health. We talk about, your divinity. But, you know, there are things going on in the world that we need to be kept abreast of. There are people that are doing positive things in the world that we need to share with one another. And so it is with that in mind that I bring you this show and this brother today. And I guarantee you, you're going to be fed spiritually, intellectually, mentally, okay? And we're going to be talking about even how you can help to with the feeding, of people, okay? You can actually help in that, okay? So I'm going to be speaking with my special guest today, who is Brother Pride Bass. And again, let me just, for those of you who don't know who he is, let me just give you a brief introduction to him. Actually, in 2005, Brother Pride launched the Third World Radio Show to expose the American public to the rich, rich African culture of Liberia through music and interviews with other Africans who were doing really positive things. And, he has just been doing things since then, since 2005. I mean, in 2008, he created a business plan to contribute to Liberia's development after 14 years of a brutal civil war that destroyed everything, including the hopes and dreams of the masses. And he was actually ready to put his plan into action, but soon realized that the funding to really make it, to make a financial impact, was a problem. So after observing that, he actually came up with a strategy and noticed that farming in Liberia is only done on a meager scale. They actually import food and other basic, more, they actually import more food and other basic items than they produce. And so his plan is to form relationships with American farmers and Liberian farmers, and American farmers with outdated farm equipment that could be reconditioned would actually donate them to Liberian farmers. And the idea caught on like wildfire throughout the East Coast Conference of the United Methodist Church. And in 2011, along with his brother, the Reverend Dogma R. Bass, who is a United Methodist pastor, they took their first reconditioned Ford tractor to Liberia. And in 2017, they shipped 3 fully conditioned Bradley walk-behind tractors to Liberia, but because of the educational and training that must be done, farming is still a work in progress. And so that's why they're actually raising funds to build an agricultural and vocational high school to serve the 7 nearby communities. And we're going to get into all of that, and you can find out how you can help in spreading the word about what's actually going on with this particular project and actually being a part of it yourself. And so it's without further ado that I bring my brother on. Brother Pride, it's a pleasure to have an opportunity to speak with you today and to share the positive work that you're doing in Liberia, my brother. Welcome to the broadcast.
Oh, thank you, my brother. It's a pleasure of mine to be on your show and to say a few words of what we are trying to do by the grace of God, that we can enlighten our brothers and our sisters, because, you know, we are our brothers' keepers. And so we have to do whatever is within our power, as long as we're living on this planet, to contribute to the positive upliftment of our people. So that is what we're trying to do.
Well, you know, again, I applaud the work that you're doing. You know, you and I, we discussed even yesterday. We were having our conversation, and you mentioned something that I know is going to stick with me, and that was that we were having a conversation, and I mentioned that when living on this planet, you want to be able to contribute something and to, you know, be a part of something that is actually benefiting the planet. And you mentioned that otherwise, if not, that when you pass on, then just like footprints in the sand, if a rain comes and you haven't left anything, the rain is just going to wash away your footprint, and it's like you were never here, you know. So, again, I applaud you for the work that you're doing so that when that day ultimately comes, you will be able to look back and have a footprint that is going to actually outlast the rain, you know. So, and that is what we endeavor to do. So, again, with everybody online, I just want to thank you for tuning in and to, again, remind you that you can join the discussion at any point. Brother Pride, if you don't mind, because I don't want to assume that people know when they hear Liberia, when they hear of Liberia, you know, just as with other African continents, we in the West, unless you've just done extensive research or a history buff, an African history buff, we don't always know what's going on with the different countries on the continent and even how these countries came to be and how they actually got from their inception to where they are now. If you don't mind giving us a brief history of Liberia and actually bring us, walk us, take us back and then walk us up through modern times to even show us how we get to where we are today with Liberia and how Liberia got to the point where they are now at the crossroads now. So if you could start with a little history of Liberia, the American Colonization Society, and bring us forward, that would be great.
Well, let's see. Liberia was founded in 1821, 22, by free American slaves that left this country because of the conditions they couldn't survive here. And educated men would always want to be free, so they decided that with the help of the American Colonization Society, that they will go and find a place in Africa where they could develop and they could call their own and make their own rules and own laws and live under their own God-given rights. Mm-hmm. So they went, and I have a ship manifest that shows that my great-grandmother was 6 years old as a passenger on one of those trips, on one of those ships back to Liberia. And
wow.
they left here, and I knew my great-grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
She was 90. She was 93 years old when she died. And I was at the funeral, at the grave. I helped to lower the casket into the grave, so I remember that. I know that.
Mm-hmm.
But they left here and went and settled. Well, they tried to settle in Sierra Leone at first, but the mosquitoes and other tropical diseases were just too much for them. So they
mm-hmm.
traveled a little bit further down the coast of the Atlantic coast down to Liberia and settled in Liberia. But when they got there, there were people there. There were indigenous people already there.
Mm-hmm.
So they negotiated with these people and said, we'd like to have some land. When they landed on a little island right off the Monrovia coast called Sherbrooke Island, Providence Island, matter of fact, it's called Providence Island. And so they were take the canoe and go back and forth to speak to the king and the leaders of the indigenous tribes that were on the coast. Now, there was some confusion I guess you said language or culture, mm-hmm. but the free slaves that left here and went back had acquired knowledge of having deed to a land, property ownership, and all of that. They understood mm-hmm. that aspect of it. But indigenous people did not consider land ownership. They believed that God owned everything.
Right.
And
if
you wanted, yeah, I mean, God, everything belongs to God, and you can use it for a certain period of time, and you leave it for somebody else to use. So land ownership was not something that they practiced. But when the educated people talked to them, they all thought they had an understanding. They thought they had convinced the people that they were, you know, respect the ownership of the deed and of the land and all of that stuff. So whatever they traded in exchange, these Africans, indigenous people, had already for years and centuries have always been able to evaluate in time whatever you give, what the value would be compared to the length of time you would spend owning the land. So the problem came about after they had gotten the land and started to build their structures and whatever. The Africans, indigenous people, decided that for what you gave us, time's up for the land. You have to turn it back over to us. And they said, no, our understanding is we paid for it. You signed the papers. And so we own the land. So that was mass confusion and mass distrust, and they had to fight, and they fought some wars, and then my mother's side came from here, even though we all came from Africa here, but on my mother's side
being to the United States,
okay. My grandmother that left here at 6 years old was on my mother's side. My father.
But you were born. You're a Liberian-born African. You were born there.
Yeah. My father was an indigenous. My father was indigenous, and all his people were indigenous people. And so when the war and we in this area that's called Bopulu right now, Bopulu is where my father's people were from, and there was a king in that area called Sawabosa was really my father's mother was related to Sawabosa. So we came to a deadline on my father's side, and he had his own army. And so when the free slaves and the indigenous people kept fighting, he came down with his army and told the indigenous people that were on the coastal line that they had signed an agreement. And whether they knew what they were signing or not, they should leave these people alone. And if they didn't leave the people alone, he was going to come with his army and he was going to, you know, get rid of them.
Mm-hmm.
So they listened to him and they stopped the fighting. And so the people were able to settle there. So they had a number of other ships that took people to Liberia. For a period of time. But Liberia was not a country. It was managed by the American Colonization Society.
I have a question for you, and that is, you mentioned that the original people who, not the indigenous people, but the freed slaves that left America and went back to Africa, they originally tried to settle in Sierra Leone, and because of the disease and the, you know, the mosquitoes and I guess the harsh living conditions, weren't able to survive. So they went from Sierra Leone into Liberia. They're not at that time already carved out borders. So was it, the plan was originally to take them back to Sierra Leone as opposed to Liberia, or was there already, had Liberia had already, this isn't the question, is had Liberia already been carved out, had that space,
no,
that place, landmass, no?
No, they were just looking for a place that would be suitable for them to live.
Okay, okay.
So at Sierra Leone, they found out that the land, the land was not suitable for them, so they decided to go travel down the Atlantic coast to see if they could find a suitable place. And if Liberia was not suitable, they would have kept going further down the coast until they found someplace. They didn't have any specific destination. They were just looking for a place that was suitable. And
so the people just came and, sounds like the people just came and dropped them off, right? It doesn't sound like they had already, you know, said, okay, this place is inhabitable. You know, this is a good place. There's plenty of, you know, food, water. You know, the living conditions are good. It just seems like they just kind of took them and just dropped them off wherever, huh?
Well, they dropped them off on an island, you know, Providence Island, which protected them from, you know, the natives that were on the mainland.
Okay.
So they were safe there because the island was vacant. So they dropped them off there. And then it was up to them to negotiate with the people on the mainland, and then that's how the conversation began.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they set up a government. They tried to set up a government. They tried to borrow money because there was no industry. The only thing they could live on was the provisions that they took on the ship with them.
Mm-hmm.
And they had no other provision until another ship came and brought some provision. So they couldn't even borrow money from anybody because they were not a sovereign nation.
Mm-hmm.
And Britain had part of Sierra Leone in control, and so they couldn't, they wouldn't loan money to the Liberian leaders. And so what they did, they declared themselves independent in 1847. They declared themselves independent nation, a sovereign nation, on July 26, 1847. So from that date, they could negotiate with foreign countries, you know, Britain, France, Germany, whatever, and they could get funds to run their operation.
And these were being done by these negotiations were being done by the freed slaves that had gone back to, not the indigenous people of Liberia.
No.
Okay.
No. The negotiation, the Declaration of Independence was done by the free slaves. And they copied the American Constitution, similar to the American Constitution. They have the three branches of government. Even our flag has the same colors, red, white, and blue. We have the 11 stripes representing the 11 signers of the Declaration of Independence. We have five whites, six red, and five whites. And the blue field at the left-hand corner. And one star. And they taught us in school that the one star was the free independent nation in all of Africa, the only free independent nation in all of Africa. Well, Ethiopia was not considered because they had a monarchy, but Liberia was the shining star in underdeveloped Africa. That's what the blue field represented. So from that point on, they began to operate and work, and I think they did a pretty good job. But the only thing they did not do was to integrate. They did not integrate the indigenous people into the society as a whole and create conditions where everybody would rise up. They did not do that. And I guess they carried some of the habits that they had formed over here where they were prosecuted persecuted. And they felt that maybe somebody felt that they were better than they were. So they, I guess when they got there, they felt that they were better than some other people who didn't look like them. So they didn't take the time to, integrate the society as a whole. And that became a problem later on in our endeavor to advance the country, because those people that were not integrated fast enough, but then a surge came along and missionaries came in and the government gave them a free hand in building schools, gave them land to build schools and educate the people. So they did that, and so most of the indigenous people got their training education from missionary schools. And when they got educated, they began to think about what these American Liberians have been doing to the country, and not including them. So that was a problem that kept boiling up from time to time, and undercurrent of resentment, and so it boiled over in 1980 when President Talbert was killed, when they had the coup in Liberia. That's the first from 1847 they never had a coup to manage the country. But they, like I said, if they had tried to integrate and set up systems that benefit all the people, I think that could have been avoided, but it didn't. They didn't.
So the coup was led by the indigenous, I'm asking, the coup was led by the indigenous people who felt that they had not been basically treated fairly or integrated into the society, and, you know, they weren't given a part in, you know, I guess running the government, and so they just basically said, you know, we're going to take it over.
Well, there's so many stories about that, but the main story is that we put it on the indigenous people and say they were upset, but there were a lot of other factors involved, and factors that we knew about, that there were contentions along the way. At one time, we had some young high school students that were adamant about the direction of the country, and they wanted to make some changes and all like that. And the old guard would say, you guys, you know, you're still staying at home with your parents, and your parents are feeding you, you haven't done anything, so you just be quiet. And excuse me. And so that would go away for a while, and then it would stir up again. But in 1980, it came about when I think President Talbert, who had been vice president for 20-some years under President Tubman, started to make some changes. He started to make some changes, and he started trying to do more integration of the society. And he was moving so fast until they called him Speedy, because he was making changes that should have been done years and years and years ago, but were never put into place. And so my own take on that is that one of the faults that came about for him was that he did not have a database of resources of personnel, because he was firing people for not showing up on time to work. You know, people have their jobs. A minister of industry would show up to work at 10 o'clock in the morning, when he should have been there around about 8:30, he'll show up at
African time, huh?
yeah, you know. He'll show up at 10 o'clock, and then at 12 he'll go to lunch, and maybe he'll come back, and maybe he wouldn't come back. And so nobody was working like they should have been working to promote the interests of the general public and the government. So he would show up to his office and sit in the chair and wait. And when the guy showed up, he would say, what happened? You should have been here. The people need you. And he fired the guy on the spot. Well, if you fire everybody on a rotational basis and you have nobody to replace them with, you start to recycle the same people that you fired and denigrated them in public. But then when you ran out of new people, you went and grabbed the same guy and said, oh, this is the greatest guy in town. I'm going to make him a chairman of the finance department. Well, yeah. Liberian people are very, very keen on picking things out. And they said, this man is not serious. Last 6 months ago, he said this guy was no good. Now he's telling us that this guy is good. So he must be foolish. He must not know what he's doing. And so that started building up, and that started building up. So it was easy for any, you know, it was like a tinderbox just waiting to be lit. And so the least little thing happened, it just blew up. And then they took all the old guards who were educated, knew how to run the government, knew how to run the system, and they arrested them in April 1980 and lined them up on the pole, tied them to a light pole. On the beach and shot them. Had no trial or nothing. And just shot them and killed them, buried them in a mass grave. So we've been fighting that ever since to overcome that process. So now the indigenous people are running the system, and those American Liberians who were related to those people that were shot on the pole have a little bit of resentment towards the indigenous people. But we'll work it out. It's going to be worked out. It's going to be working. We'll be fine. We'll be fine. People come and people go, and as long as we were able to come to a conclusion where we had we elected Ellen Johnson Sirleaf as our first female president in all of Africa, and she did the best she could with the skills and abilities that she had, and now we just had a new election with George Weah, the number one soccer player in the world in the 90s. I think it was 95. He was declared the number one soccer player in the world. And I believe I'm a, you know, I coach, you know, middle school soccer. I played soccer myself. I coached two championship teams in the United States Army when I was in the Army in the 60s and down in Texas. So I know a little bit about coaching and training and sticking to a discipline and a plan. And I did not reach the height of Mr. Weah. But for him to get to that level, as the number one soccer player in the world, he had to have some discipline, and the discipline himself towards a certain goal. And I think that if he keeps his mind on the things that he had to do to be the number one soccer player in the world, bar none, not listening to somebody who didn't want to go and train, and he went and trained anyway, if he puts people around him that have the same kind of mindset, I think he'll be fine. I think he'll be fine.
Now, he had no political experience, correct? Now, we're talking about the current president of Liberia, George Weah, correct? Okay, so he was a soccer player, became the number one soccer player in the world, and without any political experience decided that he was going to run. He had to be obviously very popular in the country. To be the number one soccer player in the world, I mean, he had to have fans, or I mean, just not just supporters, but fans. So he decides he wants to become president of Liberia. At the time he was running, he actually ran against the first woman president that had been elected to Liberia. That was his opponent.
He ran against her, and he lost. But during the war, what made him popular, I think, in Liberia, is that during the war, I understand, and I wasn't there, but from what I've heard, that he used to leave Europe where he was playing. In the off season, he would go to Liberia, and he will treat the masses, give the masses the treat, have parties for them, give them things that they needed because they were struggling. Everybody was struggling. And he was there for them. And they kind of latched onto him as somebody, as their hero, as somebody who was looking out for them. And he did that. So they became endeared to him. And so when he ran, he had all these people that he had touched with his kindness, that they felt that this man would look out, he would look out for us. And other folks would say, well, he doesn't have any political experience. He doesn't have any governmental experience. And they said, well, we don't care about that. You know, we just know that he looked out for us in the past. He would look out for us again. But, you know, that's not all there is to it, you know. The more that's, you know, you have to deal with, that's a whole lot of, that's a different paradigm altogether. But they didn't consider that, I don't think fully. But we're at a point now where the test is on. What is he going to do? Is he going to listen to himself and some of the things he did to make him the number one player in the world and try to follow that same discipline that he used? Excuse me. Or he's going to listen to other people who think they may know a little bit more than he does and try
now,
to...
Is he indigenous from... Do you know if he's indigenous...
Yes.
From an indigenous line, or is he an Afro-Liberian or American Liberian, shall I say?
America, they call him Americo-Liberian. That's what they call him. But
okay.
Now that's he's indigenous. But then again, we don't know who's indigenous anymore because
of
all the people who said they were indigenous at one time have kids that were probably born in the States. They're educated. Now, they wear suit and tie, just like the Americo-Liberians, or they wear African garb like everybody else. So the line has become blurred because we don't know. I mean, I would say if you were accusing me, accusing others for being educated, and because you were educated, you were an Americo-Liberian, when you were born there, but you did not come on a ship, in the 1800s, you didn't come on those ships. You were born there, but then they accused you because you're educated. They said you're Americo-Liberian. So what happened to these indigenous now when they become educated and wearing the same suit and tie? Are they indigenous? Are they Americo-Liberians? What are they now? What's about their kids, the second generation of their children, what are their children are. So now we don't know who the indigenous, unless you have one of the names of those people that were shot, maybe that's what they might go, might be able to identify you by. But other than that, we're all Liberians. We're all Liberians now, and I hope it stays that way.
Well, let me ask you about just to stay with the politics for a moment. So you have a lady president, okay, going back a bit. You have a lady president, and during her reign, the wars were on her watch, correct?
No, the war was before her watch.
Okay.
The war started in 1989 with Charles Taylor and Samuel Dole and that group. That's where the war was. So
but weren't there two civil wars?
No. The actual war, well, the coup was in 1980.
Okay.
The military takeover was in 1980. And Samuel Dole was installed as the president because when the assassination was over and I guess the fellas that did the job wanted to know who to leave the government, who to leave in charge of the, who would be in charge when they left. And the highest ranking person there was Samuel Dole. He was a master sergeant. So they said, all right, you hold it until the people come in the morning. And I guess when the people came in the morning, they did not want to be identified as the people that were going to point fingers at who would be shot and who would not be shot.
So right.
Yeah. So they let Samuel Dole take the whole blame for everything. And so he ran the country from 1980, even back to Ronald Reagan here in this country. And he ran the country until 1988, 1989, when Charles Taylor said he broke jail here in the States and went to Liberia. And from what I read, understood that Ramsey Clark was his lawyer. And they said he broke jail out of, I don't know where he was, in New York or New Jersey, someplace up there. But he ended up in the Ivory Coast, in Dainé, up in that area. And with weapons and everything, that they were planning to go and fight against Doe. So that's when the war actually started. And he was marching from up country, coming towards the city. And Doe was in control of the city area, and Charles Taylor advanced from the northern part of Liberia, coming down towards the coast. And so after they got rid of Doe, Charles Taylor took over and ran the country. And he got involved in so many other things. And when we talked earlier yesterday or so, we talked about the Blood Diamond in Sierra Leone. And the powers that be brought charges against him, and he got convicted of perpetrating a civil war in a neighboring country. And so they got him out of there, and he's now in The Hague. And then they had all these different factions that were fighting in the war, two or three different factions. All of them had stake and wanted to be in the lead, wanted to be the dominant party, the dominant force in the government. So they had to negotiate for them. They didn't negotiate, and I think they went to Ghana. They had the meeting in Ghana where they had all the rebel forces to meet. And they met in Ghana in a hotel. Now, these people were living, in the bush. And they did all their things in the bush. Now, you take these guys and put them in a hotel. And they got running water, they got food to eat, they got all that stuff. And they're supposed to come to some understanding, some agreement to stop the fighting in Liberia. And they weren't about to do that. They didn't want to do that because they're having a good time. They're on vacation.
Right.
So the women of Liberia, I don't know all their names. I think one of the ladies, Bowie is her name, and she received a Nobel Peace Prize. But she was the leader of the women movement in Liberia, and they have been on strike. They have been marching and protesting Charles Taylor for the longest. And they would dress up in a white outfit and line up against on the street where he was passed every day, and they would dress up in white. And how smart this lady was. She said she united all the Muslim women and all the Christian women and all the different fashion, all different religious people in one group. And they had some Muslim fighters who wanted to take over the country. And they had some different fashions. So when she brought all the Muslim women in and told them, you go home and don't have anything to do with your husbands because they don't want to stop this fighting. We want to stop this fighting because our kids are dying. Our children are dying. Our hopes are dying. So you have to do what you have to do at home. Don't make no love to home. Don't do nothing. Just close down shop.
Right.
And these,
right.
And these men started feeling it. And they said, no, we got to do something. So they came to the table to negotiate. And they're living in an air-conditioned hotel in Ghana. So they took, and dragging their feet, and they didn't want to make a decision. So these women marshaled their forces and went to Ghana. Plus you had women in Ghana who were in a refugee camp from Liberia.
Mm-hmm.
So they mustered all those people and encircled the hotel. And they said, we are not leaving until you guys come out of there with a decision. So now they're locked in, and they can't come out. And then I think the interior minister of Ghana, or foreign minister of Ghana, went with this Madam Bowie to talk to these guys, and they came to the door of the hotel, and that was shown on film, and she was talking, and one of the rebel leaders tried to slap her.
Oh my God!
And when he did that, this Ghanaian guy let loose on him. He says, "Is that how you treat your women?" He said, you are not getting out of this hotel until you make a decision. You're not leaving this place. And they locked him up in there and put the soldiers around there. And I think some of them tried to jump out of the window, and one of the soldiers came and ran to the front and told them, said, they're trying to get out of the window. They're trying to get out of the window. And they circled around where he was trying to get out. And they were there, the women. And they stayed in that place until they made a decision that they would stop the fighting. And that, because of that, they were able to usher a new election, and that's when Ellen Johnson came in. And now because all the women were able to accomplish that, well, it was easier to transition and say, we get a woman to be president, we support her. And that's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
She got in there.
Wow.
I'm
really enjoying this conversation, and I know the listeners are too, and I want to invite everybody, if you'd like to join the conversation, if you're listening by phone, all you have to do is just press 1. If you're listening online, the call-in number is 347-324-5727. Now, let me ask you a question just concerning the regional, talking about, sticking with the political piece for a second. So you have mainstream, I assume that you mentioned that the slaves that came back to Sierra Leone, Liberia set up a government that was patterned after what they had left in the United States. But as you mentioned, when they got to Liberia, there were people already there. There were indigenous people there. What was the role of the chiefs and the kings in Liberia, after the new political piece had been installed, did the chiefs and the kings still hold sway over a certain segment of the Liberian people? Did they have any power?
They did not incorporate them into the new system. They were not part of the new system. They recognized them as for formality, they gave them their due respect as the leader, and they didn't call them all chiefs. They didn't call them kings anymore. They became chiefs. So these people were still powerful in their areas. And then they divided, and the Americo-Liberians divided the country into five counties. And so you had the Montserrat County, you had Kitman County, you had the Grand Basso County, you had the Kitman County. Did I say five? Montserrat, Kitman, Grand Basso, Sano, and Kipamos. Those were the five counties they divided the country into. So So these people were just in those counties. And then what they did, they appointed their own representative as superintendents in those counties. So any authority in that county was connected to the central government in Monrovia. The representatives were people, were not indigenous people. They were American Liberians that represented those counties. And then they had schools, because they built schools and universities, and so, but they did not integrate everybody. So that's for ceremonial purposes to honor those people, but they didn't give them any power, and they may have given them some made them representatives of the government, like the king or the chief in that area would be the person who, if we wanted to interact with his clan and those people in that area, we would go to the chief and talk to the chief, or bring the chief down to Monrovia and put on a big ceremony for him and do things and kind of make him one of us and send him back to represent his people. So whenever we needed to talk to his people, we talked to his people through him. But he had no input in the decision that were made in Monrovia. They would make the decision, and then they would call him and tell him, this is what we're going to do, and then you tell your people what we're going to do. That kind of stuff, you see. Mm-hmm. If they wanted to collect taxes, he would be the guy that would collect the taxes. He would be the guy to tell the people that you need to pay a hut tax. And the hut tax, it would be maybe $5 a year or something like that. And then the government would send a tax collector up there in the different areas and collect the money. So that's what their function would have been. I think from Bopolu area, they had one man that became a representative, and he was my grandmother, my father's side brother. He was the only one, I think he was the first indigenous to become a representative in that government.
You know, all of this is very, very interesting. So when looking at the young people in Liberia, the youth or the young adults even, you know, coming up, and I assume that education has got to be something that, although it may have been frowned upon by the indigenous people because it represented, I assume, the class of Liberians who were held in disdain by the indigenous people because, you know, of course, they weren't including the indigenous people into their society, into the decision-making processes. How is education now in Liberia? Is it viewed, I mean, as we're moving, you know, further and further and, you know, quote-unquote, becoming more and more modern, how is it viewed by the younger people, and what is the education system like now? I mean, is it getting better? Are the younger people, you know, because a lot of times when people aren't a part of something, they disdain it and they, you know, they kind of throw it off like it's not important. Like, okay, if the Americo-Liberians are the ones that are in power and they're not including us into the decision-making process, and, you know, most of them have, quote, education, end quote, you know, then the people tend to shun oftentimes what they, you know, feel like, oh, you're good, you're too good, you think you're better than us. Well, forget you and your education, you know what I mean? So how is the education viewed now, and is, because, of course, people need to know how to read and people need to know how to write.
Yeah.
You know, it's only going to be a situation that can actually benefit you. So, and I'd like you, if you could, to tell the story after I ask you this question about education, to tell the story that you shared with me yesterday concerning the person and whose God was better, you know, and how they determined that. Let's do the education piece. How's the education piece in Liberia now? And Because that ties in. Remember the conversation we had yesterday when you were sharing about how a decision was made about, oh, my God is better than your God, and I can show you how. But the education piece in Liberia now, how's that? How is that? Is it getting better?
Yes, it is getting, I believe, in my opinion, I think it's getting better because, you know, education has always been important. Education has always been important to Liberians, and I might even say to Africans. They only want an opportunity. I can tell you when I was in school, I had classmates that were 10, 15 years older than I was, starting first grade, second grade, third grade, because everybody thought education was the transport. Education was the key, and you had to learn to read and write. So a lot of the indigenous people that didn't have a chance to go to school when they were 5 years old in kindergarten or 3 years old in preschool, because we didn't have preschools and we didn't have kindergarten.
Mm-hmm.
So you went to school when you were able to walk and talk. And some people that live way out, and that's what people in the cities. But people that live way out in the hinterlands, that they did not have the opportunities to go to school, they did whatever they could do until they got a chance to go to school. And so sometimes there will be 10, 15, 20 years old in the third grade.
Mm-hmm.
With people who were in Monrovia or in the cities that had elementary education and had opportunity before they did, and so education has always been important. And the thing is, what the government was doing in the early years in the 50s and so, the American-Liberians or those people that were educated did not put in a good educational structure, educational system in the country. They had government schools and all like that, but they didn't invest in those schools to make them, you know, profitable for the kids to, as far as, like I said, the teachers, you know, and the supplies, the equipment, the things that they needed. So they had a, what they call an open-door policy, and they let missionaries come in and do a lot of that stuff for them. But the government responsibility was lacking. And so because the education was important to everybody, these people would send their children overseas to go to school, little kids, 8, 9 years old. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. They'll send them to England, Switzerland, different places. And their dream was that their children would be highly educated and come back and take daddy's place or mama's place and continue the legacy.
Mm-hmm.
And they did not invest in the schools in their own countries. And that thing, it was a flaw on their part, short-sighted on their thinking, because some of us saw that and we say, well, if that's the case, I'm going to leave and go on my own and study. My father's not famous, and so I wouldn't be able to get a scholarship from them. So if I have to go overseas and wash dishes and whatever I had to do, I would do that, so when I come back, I can compete with these guys. So a lot of people left on their own. They came and went different places. So now we have a whole bunch of other people who were not in the hierarchy at that time, but now they're educated and they can think, and they've seen what things are like in foreign countries. And they can go back and try to implement some of those things that they've learned to improve the situation in the country. And so that's what's happening. Now, education has always been important. And people struggle. People did the best they could. Parents tried hard. They would work in the farms and plant whatever they could, sell whatever they could to raise money to send the kids to school. And that always been important to parents. Whether they were indigenous or non-indigenous, that's always been important. But now, I think we're coming to the point now where we're all Iberians and we should kind of realize that we're all on that piece of land right there.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to focus on what is best for the country. And if we can do that, we'll be just fine. And that's what I'm hoping, that this our new president, George Weah, would kind of remember the days when he was training to be the number one player in the world. It takes a lot of time and a lot of effort. And I make an example. Excuse me. That LeBron James did not get up one morning and start making three-point shots.
Right.
He had to take some time and discipline and training. And I understand the man still practices. He still trains. So if George Weah would say, I used to get up 4 o'clock in the morning to go running. I used to get up 2 o'clock in the morning and go running. I didn't eat certain things because that was not good for my health at that time. I mean, all of those things he learned should help him right now to move him forward. But if he forgets those things he learned, then he's going to have some problem. He's going to have some problem. Mm. Now, back to the story about the Christianization of the missionaries.
Mm.
Of the missionaries.
Yes.
Okay. Missionaries will come in, and they call the Africans heathens, and they had all kinds of different groups and societies in Europe that would come to Africa to, they said they were going to civilize the heathens. And not knowing that, you know, Africans had civilizations that were millions of years old, but they were coming to civilize the heathen. So they would come in and say, we want to, and they would give them some land, and they would build a nice building, you know, for them to stay. And they would bring some of the trinkets that they would have, you know, from the developed countries, and they would come in. And they would go, and they would try to get everybody in the area to act and be like they were. And so they would go up, you know, further in, you know, keep trying to reach more people. And they would go to a village and see a king or the chief, and they would start to discuss about God. Now, and he would say, well, your God, you worshiping trees, you worshiping animals, you worshiping this. Well, we worship this true God, so our God is better than your God. And they will get into a theological debate, and because these people had some training. These people were descendants from the pharaohs. They come all the way across Africa. They knew stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, the mm-hmm. common sense would tell them they knew stuff. So you can't come and just flim-flam them like that, you know. They were thinkers. They were creators. They knew things. So the European would say, well, your God hasn't done anything for you. You're living in a little hut like this, and you're still digging in the ground and stuff for get food to eat and all like that. See where we live, our house is nice, and our God is so good to us. And he said, well, I will tell you what, you give me one of your sons, and I'll take him and train him and let our God teach him. And then he will come back within a year, and you'll see the difference. So they'll take this young man, and they'll clean him up, put shoes on his feet, and he began to speak the language, the new language. Now he's forgotten his language, but he's not speaking that anymore. So mm-hmm. he's being indoctrinated with a new set of values. So they give him a bike and say, go visit your folks. So he goes to visit his folks, and now he's riding a little shining trinket, and everybody in the village never seen that. And they said, man, you know, this guy is good. Look how he did this child. If we had all our children like that, we'd be fine. So that's one way to do that. So then, and then they said, all right, we want to build a schoolhouse here to help you. So they build a schoolhouse, and then they said, we'll build a church right next to it. And so they build a church. But the Africans will worship under the biggest tree that they had because it was shaded. So mm-hmm. that's where they'll go and, you know, do that, whatever they would do. But that was not good enough for the Europeans. So the Europeans say, you're worshiping the tree. And the guy said, no, we're not worshiping the tree. We're just under the tree because the tree gives us shade. And they said, no, you're worshiping the tree. So he's trying to redefine in these guys' minds what they're doing. And these guys are arguing that that's not what they're doing, but they're not even listening to what these people are saying. So they go and cut the tree down and take the wood and the boards and build a church. And then they go in there to worship. And so the chief says, I'm confused now. I'm totally confused. And the European said, why are you confused? He said, you told me that I was worshiping the tree when I sat under there to contemplate and reflect on the goodness of my God. And now you cut the tree down and made boards and 2x4s and whatever, and you built mm-hmm. that building. And now we go in the building to worship now, which is still the same tree. So what's the difference? Mm-hmm. What is the difference from what I was doing to what you were doing? So it becomes a matter of not what the indigenous guy was doing, is what the missionary was trying to get him to do, to surplant his psyche and his psychology and his culture onto these people, and that's what they were doing. So the first thing to dominate the people and control is to get rid of their language. Excuse me. The culture, you get, excuse me.
Sure. Take your time, brother.
The culture, the language, or the religion, if you can change a person, change those things, then you have control. You have domination, you control. So that's what they do. And that's how they've been able to reproduce themselves within us. So we may find that sometimes we behave and we act like we are in the culture. Like they say, when you're in Rome, you do like the Romans. So now we all become Europeans. We are Africans. But we behave like Europeans. And until we get to the point where we start to say, wait a minute, what are my African values? What are the values of my ancestors? What were my ancestors like? What did they do? How were they able to build kingdoms? How were they able to do things that they were able to do that the world still has to figure out? You know, they're still digging in Egypt to find out what these people were doing. There had to be some tough, bad people to have built things that the world has not figured out yet for all these number of years. So those are our people. Those are our people.
Yes, sir.
Those are our people. So what are we going to do to help change this paradigm? How we do that? So we'll do that through education, through training, our history. We have a number of brilliant African scientists, African scientists that have written books and have given us a whole lot of literature. They have studied in Egypt. They have studied the pyramids. They have studied the languages. They read the hieroglyphs, and they're informing us of these things that we didn't know or we have not been exposed to. And so we need to read and study and learn and study, because wisdom is not constant. It's changing. It's always been here. And one group of people don't have all the wisdom. So we have to, you know, we have to study. We have to read. We need to talk about and read about John Henry Clark, Yusuf Ben Jonathan, Ivan Ben Sertiman. One guy that I really like, but he passed away, is Amon Wilson. Chancellor Williams, Francis Crest Wesley. I mean, there are a number of people. I read, I study a lot about Marcus Garvey. These are people who we can kind of call on when we need to get some directions.
I want to add somebody to that list. I don't know if you're familiar with Rahu Nefer Amen. He's a living sage, actually, for lack of a better term. I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but I would definitely add him to the list of the notable people that you mentioned. And you mentioned Egypt and the pyramids and that information. And when we look back and we say, wow, they must have been bad, as I don't know what, for them to have created systems and even, you know, just things that the world looks at today and can't figure out how it's done. And even when you think about Kemetic, as it's noted today, called today, spirituality, it's like, okay, there's a system that it's like, how do we apply that? How do we take that, the information that they left us, you know, on the walls of the hieroglyphics, that they left us, that these people actually left us, how do we take that and apply it today? Because the same God that they were worshiping, because there's only one God, as we'll agree, is still here, you know, today. Yeah. So how do we take the information that and build upon it, understand it, you know, and apply it today? And he, Rahu Nefer Amen, is somebody who is actually teaching and sharing today on those values and that spiritual system that actually was utilized by the ancient Egyptians to create what it is that they created. So I would like to add his name to the list. And if you're not familiar with his work, I can definitely, you know, share some information with you that I know that you would really appreciate.
I appreciate that. That would be good. See, that's what the Egyptians, what the Africans did in Egypt, in Sudan, in Ethiopia, in the southern part of in Malawi, in Zimbabwe, and all those places. In Tripoli, in Mali, in Ghana, in Songhai, all that these people did was the spirit of Africa. And you know, in my study, I just came across a thought, and I say the original name of Africa. The original name of Africa was Eden. Was Eden. Because in the Bible it says God planted a garden east in Eden. East in Eden. And one of the rivers ran out of Ethiopia. That's right there in the Bible. I didn't write that.
Mm-hmm.
So the western boundary of the garden was the Nile River. And the eastern boundary of the garden was Tigris-Euphrates River in that area. So all of that area there was Africa. All of that area there was Eden. The garden was just east in Eden, on the eastern side of Eden. He didn't say, He didn't say, I've got a garden east of Eden, then that means it would be excluded from the mainland. But he said east in Eden, and the Nile River runs right out of Ethiopia. So come on now. We've been just going around in circles and stuff. And like, so we're trying to do all of that, some of that, and I try to share that with some people at my church. Matter of fact, I got a class this evening. And those are some of the things we talk about. But
It sounds like you all are on the right path, my brother. I mean, because sharing this information is the beginning. Sharing it, and then you can get people to share it and understand it, and then to take it another step and to live it. You know, there's an ancient Egyptian saying that to know truth, you must live it. You know, so. But I definitely want, I mean, I know we could talk forever, but I want to share with the people about the program that you have, Farmer to Farmer, where you are actually connecting it's gotten to the point, you know, fast forward to where we are today. And, you know, when you shared with in your bio, but even about Liberia, they actually export more food or a lot of the same food that they could actually grow themselves. And, you know, could you talk about the program Farmer to Farmer and, you know, let our listeners know what you're doing as far as that goes?
Sure, certainly. Thanks for that. I came to this country in 1965. I did not go back until 1979. And when I went back, it so happened that Dr. Andrew Young was the representative to the United Nations for this country. And he was visiting Liberia at the same time. And he had a news conference. And he said, God is going to ask you the questions. Why are you importing rice, which is your main staple food? Your main staple food is rice. Why are you importing rice when you have all this sunshine, you have all the rain, you have everything you need to grow rice? And matter of fact, that area there used to be called the Green Coast. We grew rice in that place. We exported rice from that place. And I'm sure he knew the history of that place, Liberia. So he said, why are you doing this? So after the war, I went back to visit, and I saw President Sully was the president. I went back, I started going back in 2011 and 12, and since that time, I've been going back every year. Matter of fact, I'm going this November. I'm taking a team of people to go and help to do some work over there. But through the church, we have been helping with schools, clinics, and churches. And I reasoned to myself that if you're just going to help somebody, teach them how to pray and read the Bible and sing a song and clap around and then get back in the plane and come back to the States, I don't think that's enough. That's not sustaining. You're not sustaining these people because they have to find food to eat. They have to find a way of providing for their livelihood. So I said, well, if we add, and it was called 3 C's, churches, clinics, classrooms, 3 C's.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got connected with them, I said, listen, we're going to have another C here, and the C is going to be crops.
Mm-hmm.
We need to teach people how to make farms and grow crops that they can feed themselves and take care of themselves and buy things for themselves and make some money, some hard currency where they can send their children to school, then send their children to the doctor if they need to. But if they wait for you to go every so often and give them stuff, that's not helping them. So we need to empower them so that they can be able to sustain their lives. So that's where the concept came about. But then how do we do that? So I decided we'll find some farmers in the States, and we have a lot of farmers in Ohio that have all kinds of equipment that they don't use anymore. because, you know, the manufacturers put out new renditions every so often. And mm-hmm. so they just go and buy these new toys. So I said, well, what are you going to do with that? Well, we don't need that anymore. Well, could we fix that up and ship it to Liberia and help these farmers? And so I ran into a minister, Pastor Ake, Ray Ake, and I explained the project to him, and he said, well, I got farmers in my church. Let's get started. And that's how Farmer to Farmer was born. And mm-hmm. we sent our first tractor over. Me and my brother took the first tractor over there, and then we just sent some other things. Now, I wrote the community a letter as a son of that community, and I shared my ideas with them, what I was trying to do, and how the community would be benefited. But I needed some land.
The community in Liberia.
Harrisburg, in Liberia.
Okay, Harrisburg, Liberia. Okay.
Yeah, I wrote them a letter, and they read the letter, and they said, you are one of our sons, and you think much of us to come back to bring some progress to our community. We're very happy about that. So we'll give you 37 acres of land. I just got the deed in my hand about a week ago.
Mm-hmm.
We had the land surveyed, probated, and everything. We got the land. So now we're going to start to build a school to teach the kids, because now there's no high school in the area. They have to walk 2.5 hours one way to go to school every day. And kids drop out of school because of that, you know. They can't maintain the stamina. So they just drop out of school. So we're going to make it easy for them to get an education, and then we're going to have an agriculture component where we'll train farmers how to use the machinery and to repair them, and they can make bigger farms. And then we're going to build factories on the land that will process the food that they will buy, all the food that they can produce, all the crops they can produce, and we will process the food. And we may export some of that. And because just the gari, for instance, you know, right now you can buy gari in the market. The ladies were having a big pan that's open, and it's driving the flies from it, you know. So if we process it and put it in little packages and send it, you know, in a sanitary way, then we can, you know, we create some standard and, you know, cut down on the diseases, you know, of the people. So it will be healthy for them too. It will be a good contribution to the health industry in the country, and so we'll be able to process the food and ship some overseas and make some hard currency that we can do some other things with. We could grow tomatoes. We import tomato paste. We eat a lot of tomato paste in Liberia, you know. So if we grew tomatoes, we could make our own tomato paste. So that's another industry that people can learn how to operate and get jobs right there. And so that's the vision. That's the vision. We want to build a sustainable system. And if we can lift this one place up that everybody in the country can come and see, and say, wow, that is great. You guys did a good job. How can we do that in my place? Even right now when I go, they want to know, people coming around, what can we do? Can you help us do this? Can you help us do that? And I said, well, let's do this first. When we do this first, then I'll have you bring your team of people from your community, and we will train them here and show them what they need to do, and we will support them in your community. But we will not come in your community to do for you what we are doing here. You have to bring some people from that are interested in your community, and we will work with you. So that's what we're doing. That's what we're doing. And I think it is well received. The church, I'm thankful to the East Ohio United Methodist Church is very excited about what we're doing. And now we are in the process of connecting with the global system. And if we connect with the global system, which I'm sure we're going to have that done by the end of this year, we will be invited teams from all over the world to come. And what these teams do, they raise their own money, and we say we have a project. We want to build a tomato processing plant And whoever has the skills and the material and the know-how to do it, they will raise their own money to go and build that and then teach the people how to use it, how to operate it. So that's the kind of thing, that's what we're doing.
Wow, brother, it sounds like you got a lot of positive going on. How has been the response, when you share this information with people, because I know that there are people when it comes to even things of Africa and, you know, going over and helping, you know, there's a perception, you know, and
mm-hmm.
especially when you're talking about, for example, a country like Liberia that, you know, was dealing with the war, people are concerned about their safety, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you say to someone who says, listen, you know, I really want to be involved, you know, it sounds like you got an awesome program, I'd like to learn more, but, you know, can you assure me, you know, that if
yeah.
I go over there with you, that I'm going to be able to come back?
Yeah. Well, the country is, the last time I was there, it was safe, and I was just there in January 2017. I was there for 2 weeks, and we just had a team come back in 2018, January 2018. A team was just there. And that's just from our conference. Well, that's just two teams from farmer to farmer. Let's say just teams from farmer to farmer. But there are other teams from the East Ohio Conference that are going over there. They've been going over there for the last 10, 12 years. So the place is safe. It's even safe for the Ebola crisis that was there, because right after the World Health Organization declared Liberia was safe from safe to travel because the Ebola had been arrested, the church, our East Ohio Conference, sent three of us to Liberia to go and assess what happened in our areas. So mm-hmm. I was one with three that went, me, our chairperson, and her husband, who is a medical doctor. So the three of us went over there for 10 days, and we traveled to all the mission projects that we're doing in Liberia. And we saw that things were fine, the people were doing just well. And so there's no fighting now. We got a new government. And as far as I know, there's no fighting, and so you're safe. And if you weren't safe, the United States Embassy, they will let us know, and it won't be safe to travel there. So
mm-hmm.
as long as they have not said that, you know, I would just take their word and say that it is safe to travel, and you come back. And we have some precautions. We have insurance that if something happens, you got sick, you got medical care while you're there, or if we have to come back to the States, that provision made that you come back. So we got everything on. We got everything organized. Matter of fact, the medical
not to
I wanted.
This. Another perception I remember speaking to a African friend of mine, and he had come and he was saying that he was trying to get his family to come, but everybody had come but his sister. And I would say, why she didn't come? He said, because she said it's not safe to come to the United States. You know what I'm saying? So, it's all about perception. You know, people here thinking about it might not be safe to go over there. There are people there that don't want to come here because they don't think it's safe. You know, so,
yeah.
You know, it's all, you got to take it all as a grain of salt. But, you know, and it's real. These people's, thoughts are real on it. I'm not trying to laugh it off. I mean, but, people are concerned about safety, and that's one of
and
the big pieces.
Be.
So I just, yes,
and
yes.
It should be.
And so I wanted to make,
be.
Yes.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
brother,
if they're
going
to pay
their
money to go, if they're going to pay their money
yeah.
to go, they want to be safe. Yeah, I understand that. And we try to guarantee, we try to assure them, and we protect them and make sure they get the right, you know, they don't drink their water wet. You know, they drink bottled water. You know, we buy bottled
mm-hmm.
water for everybody. So that's, and they take the malaria tablets every day. And I say, make sure you take your tablets today. And so everybody
mm-hmm.
takes their pills. So we all right. We're fine.
You know, brother, it sounds like you have really got something going on over there. I mean, just in a positive way, rebuilding, excuse me, the country, and helping people to become self-sufficient, helping teaching people skills, excuse me, that are going to help them to be able to provide for their families, like you said, to be able to make ensure that their children have education. And, you know, again, I really am impressed by the third C that you added to the three C's, you know, the fourth C, shall I say, you know, the crops, you know, because a lot of times churches and spiritual, you know, organizations oftentimes get so caught up in the spirit, shall I say, that the earth realm, you know, is just left undone, you know, and the things that people have to deal with every day. Okay, how do I support my family? How do I make sure there's food on the table? You know, all of these things are left undone and they aren't taught. So, you know, I really applaud you for that work that you're doing in Liberia. And if there's any way that I can assist you in helping to make connections here, if you ever want to, you know, come on the show to share what it is, give us updates on what you're doing. And you mentioned that you can, you know, if people wanted to get in contact with you, how can they reach you, you know, to get more information? Or if you mentioned you're going, I believe you said, was it November that you're going, and people might say, well, listen, hey, I'd like to go. I'd like to be a part of it. I'd like to help. How can they contact you?
Well, they can contact me through my email address, which is pridebass, PRYDEBASS at yahoo.com. That's all small case, PRYDEBASS at yahoo.com. Or they could call me at 216-401-4663. That's 216-401-4663. If you'd like to check out, we have a website, Farmer to Farmer, Farmer number two, Farmer at CO, that CO, what did I give you the other day?
Okay, let me see here, Farmer to Farmer. I don't have it in front of me, but what I will do is I will definitely give it out again.
It's on a website.
It's Farmer to Farmer at... No, that's not it. I was looking at something else here. No, but I will definitely give it out.
FarmerToFarmer.co. FarmerToFarmer.co.
Mm-hmm.
Farmer number two, to Farmer.co.
Yeah, .co. .co. And again, the phone number again for you?
216-401-4663.
You know, Brother Bass, again, there are a lot of people that it's easy oftentimes, and a lot of times when people look at the state of affairs in the world and they look at what's going on, not only in their own communities, but around the world, you know, a lot of times people get together and they, you know, complain about this and they think and talk about how things should be. Maybe even talk about the good old days, how things used to be, you know.
Yeah.
But then you have people like yourself that get together and talk about not just the way things used to be, but the way things can be if we, people that are here today, actually do something to create that world that we're looking for, you know.
Yeah.
And so for the work that you do, you know, in actually doing, you have talkers and then you have doers, you know, and you're actually doing the work to make your country, you know, and I say your country, although you are, you know, an American now, you know, and not to ever take away from your Africanness, you're African and you're an American, you know, but to do the work that a lot of other people just talk about, you know, is to be commended, and I thank you for that. Any parting words for our listeners today before we go?
Well, I would say I'm a believer in God, and I learned what I've learned from my parents. My father was a United Methodist minister, and my mother was very active in the church She's 99 years old right now. We thank God for her life, and we are following in their footsteps. And I tell my family all the time that our parents work very hard, very hard, and we cannot let their legacy go by the wayside. We have to maintain that for our children and our children's children. So we give honor to God, and He's given us the strength and the desire and the compassion to do what we're doing, and we will continue to do this until we leave this place. So anyone wants
to join my brother,
us,
may God continue to open doors for you and connect you with the people that you are to be connected with to assist you in this work, because it's not just your work, it's God's work, you know, and this earth belongs to God. You know, I'm thinking about the earlier in the conversation you were talking about how the indigenous people looked at the land and said, this is all God's land. Well, that includes the earth, you know.
Yes.
And so if the earth is God's, then this work is God's too, you know.
Yeah.
And so, again, I thank you for that work that you're doing, brother. And if there's anything that I can do to assist you with it, please feel free to let me know. And, again, I'd love to have you back to continue this discussion because it's been powerful. And I encourage everybody to go back and listen to this show again. This show is going to be archived. Approximately 30 minutes after the show, it's going to be archived. And you can go back and you can listen to it again and again, and you can share it with other people that you know. Brother, I'm going to extend an invitation for you to come back on, and we can talk some more just about the work that you're doing, and we can also talk about Liberia and the positive work that's going on. And you gave us a history lesson today. I learned a lot, and I know my listeners did too. Thank you, and you're invited to come back at any time.
You're welcome, sir. Thanks for inviting me. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Talk to you soon. Everybody, that is Pride Bass, and I guarantee you that you are going to enjoy listening to this show again. So I encourage you to go back and listen to this show again and to give Brother Pride a call and to email him, okay, and to find out how that you can be a part in helping to make a difference in the lives of the Liberian people who have, you know, undergone a lot in recent years. You know, am I my brother's keeper? Yes, I am. And my name is Juwanza, and again, I thank you so much for your time, everybody. Again, scroll through the archives. There's bound to be some shows that you love. You can actually follow the show. All you have to do is just click follow. If you're listening on via Blog Talk, just follow the show, and every time we do a show, you'll be notified of the date, the time, the guest, and the topic. All right? So, again, thank you so much for your time. Thank you, Brother Bass. Oh, man, I learned a lot today about Liberia, and I can't wait to learn some more. So I'm waiting for the next interview already. Everybody, my name is Juwanza. Who am I? I'm the one who, in giving, receives more. Who are you? It's out.